tips on how to behave here in the quarantine block. Whatever else, he had to take it easy and not get wound up about anything. If he had heeded that advice, everything would have been all right. But right from the start, he began making conscientious and precise requests for all of the measures he deemed necessary. A dish containing disinfectant solution for people to wash their hands was needed at the door of every room. Everyone had to be subjected to a medical inspection every morning to identify new cases of scarlet fever as quickly as possible. There had to be an outpatient's clinic every evening. A small room needed to be cleared for the patients who, according to instructions, were not allowed to go to the Krankenbau and for possible cases of scarlet fever. A few quarantined French doctors could help him. When Hans presented his list, the Block L tester answered with that same ironic smile, "It will all be taken care of, doctor." Hans was busy all day with these measures, none of which were carried out. There were no dishes for disinfectants. The Krankenbau chemist refused to supply medicine for non-hospital blocks. The Block L tester didn't have a spare room to set up a ward for the sick. After all, there were 1,200 people in his block. They were already sleeping three to a bunk. But Hans felt that more than just the impossibility of enacting his measures, it was deliberate obstruction. Heinrich, the Stubenel tester whose cubicle Hans was sharing, even said as much. He wore a purple triangle next to the number on his breast, the symbol for Bible students. Every evening there was a small meeting when all of the Bible students would gather with Heinrich. There weren't many, five or six in all of Auschwitz. That hadn't always been the case, Heinrich told me. Everyone in Germany who used the Bible to demonstrate the evil of the Nazi system and predict its downfall, the Jehovah's Witnesses, had been systematically picked up. The same had happened to those who believed in other prophecies, such as the divine message of the Great Pyramid or the prophecies of Nostradamus. At one stage, there were 800 of them together in Dachau. The Lagerführer had them all line up on Roll Call Square. Who still believes in the truth of biblical predictions? All hands were raised. The Sturmmänner picked out 10 men who were shot on the spot. Then again, who still believes? Again, all hands were raised. Again, 10 victims fell. It went on like that, but with every round of that dance of death, more people were struck by doubt, and fewer hands were raised, until finally only the converted were left, though only after 100 of the best had fallen. They were sometimes wearying, the Bible students, because no matter what you said, no matter what happened, they were always ready with a Bible quote, regardless of how irrelevant it was. But they were honest, they had your best wishes at heart, and they knew what was what in the camp. "Be careful, son," Heinrich warned Hans. "Don't make things too difficult for them with all your precautions. Before you know it, you'll be in deep trouble." A few days later, the SS doctor came. He kicked up an enormous fuss and gave Hans a dressing down because all kinds of measures to prevent an epidemic hadn't been taken. Stupidly, Hans was too sporting to answer that he had ordered the measures but hadn't received any cooperation from the Block L tester. Now the Block L tester was thwarting him even more because he thought Hans's silence had been motivated by fear. The only one to help Hans at all was a young Czech colleague. He had been put in the camp as a homosexual, but because he wasn't Jewish and, as a Czech, could speak Polish with the Block L tester, he was sometimes able to get things done. Ivar became a good friend. He told Hans how he had got his pink triangle. "A party member in Prague had an old debt to me. When I insisted on payment, he set the Gestapo on me with a statement about how he had supposedly caught me performing homosexual acts. Anyway, Hans, you know how German justice works. I never admitted anything, and nothing was ever proven. but a single Nazi witness counts more than the best alibi. I could have proven I wasn't in Prague at all on the day of the crime, but they don't give you a chance. The next day, Hans experienced German justice firsthand. He was at work upstairs in a corner of the attic, where 10 unfortunate patients were bedded down on a thin, filthy layer of straw, when the gong for the roll call sounded. As it took at least half an hour from the gong until the arrival of the SS man, the Stubenältester hurried down to Hans's room to let them know to take him into account. But when Hans went downstairs a little later, the count had still been wrong. The Blockältester had been called in, and the moment Hans entered the room, he started to abuse him, shouting cholera and 100 other Polish swear words. Hans tried to clarify the situation and apologize, but the Blockältester grew more and more agitated, and then, without warning, punched him several times hard in the face. Blood gushed from Hans's nose, and his glasses lay shattered on the floor. But worse than the smashed glasses and his crooked nose, broken by the first blow, he was now a lost cause in quarantine. All of the Stubenältester and their assistants, the clerks and orderlies, were laughing at him. Nobody listened to him anymore. That evening, Hans discussed it with Krutkov, one of the few Russians who spoke a little German. He had been the head of a kolkhoz, a collective farm with some 2,500 workers. When the Germans arrived, they had all refused to continue working. A lot of them were shot dead on the spot. He was here in the camp with a couple hundred of his people. They all had black triangles, antisocial, work shy. Imagine, people who had worked like horses, who had turned their village with its hovels and muddy fields into a fabulous vast farm, who knew better than anyone in the whole world the meaning of community, a community of workers and peasants, and working for that community, labeled here as antisocial. What did it matter what kind of triangle you wore here, how you were appreciated here? Look around at all the people imprisoned here, the Russian continued. Most of them are Polish, with those red triangles with a P on them, political prisoners. But I guarantee you that 90% are black marketeers, or that their political activities were at most stupid statements they made when drunk. The Germans with a red triangle are more likely to be real political prisoners. Some of them have been imprisoned for 10 years. But there aren't many here. Most of them are already dead anyway. Then you've got the Russians, who, as I said, mostly have black triangles. In reality, they're actual political prisoners, because their refusal to work was a political act. The worst scum are often the Greens. If the triangle is pointing up, they're Berufsverbrecher, professional criminals. Pointing down means an occasional criminal. In the camps, they get to lord it over the others. As Lagerältester, some of them have the deaths of hundreds of fellow prisoners on their consciences. But that, too, is all so random. I knew a German from Cologne who scattered political pamphlets from a plane in 1936, anti-Nazi, of course. He was caught, and they proved that he had accepted money from an illegal organization to pay for the printing costs. They gave him a green triangle as a criminal. If he'd printed them at his own expense, it would have been a red triangle. Evening had fallen in the meantime, and Hans needed to check upstairs for a moment. It was a large attic, sleeping 300, almost all of whom were lying directly on the cement floor. They were all Jews. A few days earlier, a Jew had been caught urinating in a food bowl. Sometimes they weren't allowed outside for half a day, and this fellow had a bladder complaint and couldn't hold it in that long. That was why a friend from a work block had brought a separate bowl for him, but those excuses weren't accepted. They beat him black and blue, and as always, if one Jew had done something wrong, all of the Jews were swine. The Blockältester had seized the opportunity to move them all up to the attic, simultaneously making room on the lower floors for the Poles, who no longer had to sleep more than two to a bunk. The attic was a ghastly shambles. An unpolished cement floor, a leaky roof, and two small windows to provide fresh air to 300 people. The men had to lie on the floor in their linen uniforms with one blanket for two men. In the daytime, they jostled for a seat on a couple of rafters or had to stand because there were neither chairs nor tables. They had been living like this for 5 weeks now, as none of them were allowed to leave the block because of the scarlet fever. All the sick prisoners from the entire block were crammed into a corner that was partitioned off with walls made of board. The filth was appalling. Still, there was an advantage to this, as they weren't being trampled by the hundreds of others shuffling back and forth across the attic. But if a Pole or a Russian fell ill, all kinds of difficulties arose. Of course, the patient would rather stay in bed downstairs than move up to the filthy, sick corner, but sick prisoners weren't allowed to stay in the rooms because of the risk of contagion. After all, you could never say in advance that a particular case of angina with a 104-degree fever was definitely scarlet fever. The patient would scheme a little with the Stuben-L-tester, who in turn spoke to the Block-L-tester, and then, regardless of what Hans had ordered, the sick prisoner stayed just where he was. It was clear that he didn't belong there from a hygiene point of view, but from the sick man's perspective, it was very understandable. In the attic, he wouldn't get any rest or fresh air, and would receive no more treatment than downstairs. There were almost no bandages and even less medicine. For 2 days, Hans was given 30 aspirins for 1,200 people. And with all these prisoners jammed in together, many of them fell ill. It had taken quite a lot of effort for him to get those 30 tablets. He'd had to go to Dering, the head of the Krankenbau. The patients were lying in their corner. Several of them had a high fever and hadn't been able to eat for days because their throats were so sore. There was a special kitchen for restricted diets attached to the Krankenbau, but to use it, you needed a note from the Block-L-tester, who didn't have time for things like that. Still, it was very stupid of Hans to complain to Dering the following day about the conditions and about the Block-L-tester hitting him. At first, Dering kicked up an enormous fuss, saying that a Block-L-tester hitting a doctor was a disgrace and an insult to the whole Krankenbau. But then the Block-L-tester himself joined them. They talked a little in Polish, and Dering calmed down. He would investigate the matter further. An hour later, he sent for Hans again. "I see that you don't have enough tact for this situation. You're going back to the block where you first worked." When he got to Block 9, they had already heard about it. Zelina, the head doctor, ridiculed him for having let them ride roughshod over him like that. Hans was sent to Dr. Valentin, the head of outpatients. "You were lucky. Dering could have reported you to the Lagerarzt immediately. Then you would have gone straight into a coal mine." "Oh well, whether they get rid of you today or next week."
"What do you mean?"
"Ah, Dopey doesn't know anything about it, of course. Haven't you heard of the Pfleger cutback? Sorry, Pfleger transport?"
"What's that?"
"Next week, 60 Pfleger have to go to Buna. They say they're setting up a new hospital there."
"That's not so bad," Hans ventured.
"Boy, are you naive," Valentin mocked. "They say they're going to Buna as Pfleger and doctors, but you'll see that not one of them ends up in the infirmary unless it's as a patient who's been worked half to death."
Things didn't look good. Hans had only been in the camp for a relatively short period. He would be sent away before others who had been here much longer. That evening, he discussed the situation with Eli Polak and Klempfner, a Czech doctor from the upstairs ward. Klempfner had already spent 4 years in various camps and knew the ins and outs.
"Don't worry," he said. 10 people have to go from this block, but you'll see you won't be one of them."
"How do you know that?"
"Zelina is making the list, and he thinks highly of both of you."
Well, I'm sure he doesn't think highly of me any more after the way I made a fool of myself in quarantine, Hans sneered. Don't say that. You didn't make a fool of yourself at all. You were much too fair, of course, and you have far too many scruples. You wanted to stick up for the sick, and that rubbed his lordship, the Blockel tester, the wrong way because it was too much work. But Jelena's a fine fellow, and he's well aware of what's really going on. You mustn't lump all Poles into the same basket. Klempner was right. A few days later, Jelena let Hans know unofficially that everything would be all right. He was going to keep him and Ailey because he thought the Dutch were decent types. Still, there were victims among the Dutch prisoners all the same, Tony Hoogsteen and Gerard van Wyk. Jelena's not keeping them was understandable. They weren't doctors, and they had been in the camp the shortest. Tony wasn't popular. He was nervous, yelled at the patients terribly, and got into regular conflicts with the other Pfleger. But Hans thought it was an awful shame about Gerard. He was a gentle, intelligent lad. He was fairly weak and had already coughed up blood a couple of times. What are they going to do with us? Gerard asked. Well, you're going to that new hospital there. Hans didn't actually believe this, but what use was there in upsetting the poor fellow even more? The Pfleger left on a Wednesday. They had washed, and they were wearing new clothes. That was a bad sign, because Pfleger or doctors who were really going to keep working in their profession didn't need to swap their clean suits for rags. On Thursday afternoon, when Hans arrived with a soup kettle, he found the women in Block 10 in something of a panic. Professor Zamwell had been taken away from his work that morning on orders of Standortarzt Wirtz, the SS doctor in charge of all Lagerärzte in the Auschwitz area. The rumor was that he had to go to Birkenau to find new female subjects for their experiments. The girls were convinced that the block's current residents would then be put in outside commandos. They had submitted to the experiments and would end up dying like dogs in a gravel pit anyway. Hans had heard a different story and reassured Friedel. For the last couple of weeks, there's been a conflict between Zamwell and Klauberg. It seems that Zamwell wanted to protect the staff more and asked the Standortarzt if 40 deserving women who worked in the block and were already on his list could be exempted from the Klauberg experiments. It's possible, Friedel said. There's so much conniving going on here. Yesterday, Breuda had an enormous quarrel with Sylvia, Klauberg's assistant, a foul girl. She already said a month ago that the staff were all going to be done, too. After characters like that have been in a camp for 2 or 3 years and obtained some power, they forget they're prisoners themselves, too. Who's Breuda? Hans asked. Our current Blockel tester. She's a doctor, but she sabotages the experiments when she can. Hans went to Block 9 to hear what Klempner thought. If Zamwell gets shot at Birkenau, Breuda won't stay on as Blockel tester either, he said. Then they'll probably use the staff for experiments too? Probably. But is that so bad? It's better than the first interpretation, that Zamwell's gone to get new guinea pigs. They're better off getting an injection than being sent to Birkenau. Those experiments aren't that terrible. Sure, those Greek girls were horribly mauled, but among Klauberg's subjects, there's only been the sporadic death and a few cases of peritonitis, and we don't actually know the percentage of infertility. Hans agreed with Klempner in as much as anything was better than Birkenau, but he couldn't go along with his opinion that the experiments weren't that terrible. Even if they only harm a single hair on those women's heads, it's still as bad a crime as a major operation, because the nature of the crime is not determined by the seriousness of the experiment, but by the compulsion under which it is carried out. Anyway, if the experiment wasn't serious, they wouldn't have to force prisoners to take part. If I want to set up an innocent study, I can find people who are willing to volunteer to take part at an ordinary clinic. Their using prisoners is proof in itself that something's wrong. Economically, capitalist progress often comes at the expense of workers. But Ige Farben wanting progress at the expense of our women's bodies, that's something that not even modern capitalism would approve in any country except Germany.
You're right there, Klempfner replied. It really is remarkable that the fascists, when protecting big business, whose tool they are, so often resort to pre-capitalist means.
How's that?
Take their power structure. It's pure feudalism. Here in the camp, you see it in a stylized version.
A camp is a kind of duchy.
The Lager-Eltester is the liege lord by the grace of the SS. He exercises his power by granting privileges. The Block-Eltester are the counts. Their position as petty potentates allows them to organize. Their staff are like minor nobility terrorizing the land. Take our block's doorkeeper, for example. In an ordinary hospital, the doorkeeper is paid a wage for the work he does. Here, he's a person of power. From each visitor he allows in, he demands a cigarette or more. Each service he carries out for a patient has to be paid for. That's how he looks after number one. Only the masses, who don't have a position of power, die on a liter of soup and a ration of bread a day. It's the crudest possible connection between power and rights. Completely undemocratic. Feudal. When Hans went to go downstairs, someone called out to him.
Hello, Van Damme. Are you here too?
Lying on a middle bunk was a tall young man, skin and bones, and too weak to raise himself up in bed.
Lex, how long have you been here?
It was Lex von Veren, the jazz trumpet player Hans used to play with now and then.
Did you know that Jack de Vries is here too? Lex asked. He's working in one of the mining commandos. And Maurice von Kleef, he's in the Birkenau Orchestra.
How did he manage that?
In Birkenau, Jews are allowed in the orchestra. It's got a load of Dutch celebrities in it, Johnny and Jonas, and Han Hollander, too.
They reminisced, and Lex told him what it had been like in Jawischowitz, in the coal mine. With two of you, you have to fill 40 carts a day. That's the same amount as the civilian workers, the professional miners. But they know the trade. And if you don't know how to use a pickaxe, you don't get a single coal loose. That means a beating. The first day, we only filled 5 carts. That was so little it counted as sabotage. But believe me, it's the most you can manage. For punishment, they put us in the Stehbunker that night. That's a cellar that's too low to stand up in, but you can't lie down either, because there's an inch of water on the floor. So you spend the whole night bent over in the pitch black. You can understand how rotten you feel the next day, and that you're hardly able to work at all. Then you get another beating and different punishments. No one can bear treatment like that. The civilians get normal food with a miner's supplement. We have to live off a ration of bread and a liter of soup. When the miners get back home, they have some peace and quiet. They go to sleep or spend an hour in the pub, but we have roll call with knee bends, flat on your stomach in the mud. Stand up, lie down, stand up, and so on for hours on end. Then into your bunk. 8 men on one wide wooden bed, cold, no rest. At 4 in the morning, they wake you up, and it starts all over again. No chance to be sick. Diarrhea? Get to work. Fever, get to work, until you're this close to death. And the risks underground. They don't take any safety measures at all in the galleries where prisoners work. Accidents all the time. Stupid, because their own production suffers as a result. We arrived half a year ago with 1,000 people from Holland. They picked out 300 men. The rest were probably gassed. We, the 300, were sent to the mines. About 15 are alive now. I was lucky. One day the Lager-Eltester came traipsing up with an old French horn. How he got it, I don't know. But he asked me if it was true that I could play the trumpet.
Then I played for the Rapportführer, Silent Night. It was Christmas, and all evening they wanted to hear the same thing over and over again. Silent Night. I had to think of the night in the Stehbunker. Anyhow, then they made me a room orderly. I didn't need to go down in the mine anymore. I had to clean the barracks, fetch bread, and do jobs like that. Now and then I played something for the big shots, then I got something extra to eat. Yes, you need a special stroke of luck here, otherwise they grind you down without mercy. Indeed, gentlemen, indeed, an affected posh voice came from the top bunk. What kind of joker are you? Hans asked. My name's Menko, and it's true I am a joker, but I've been playing jokes on the SS. I've been imprisoned since January 1941. Hans gave him a disbelieving look. Transports to Poland hadn't even started in January 41. No, I was picked up with the Heusen. At the trial in 41, they sentenced me to death. What are you doing here, then? Another Dutchman interjected. You, sir, are another joker, but a damned feeble one. Nonetheless, I shall answer you. I have been through at least a dozen prisons and just as many camps. But as is so often the case with people who have been sentenced to death, you wait for your execution and it doesn't come. The most extreme is Buchenwald. There are hundreds of prisoners there who have been sentenced to death. Now and then they send a transport to Nebellager Natzweiler. Why is it called a Nebellager? Patience, gentlemen. In Natzweiler, the executions take place zwischen Nacht und Nebel, at the crack of dawn. That has something mystical and heathen about it. The Übermensch is full of these atavistic tendencies. Anyway, I was supposed to go on a transport to Natzweiler. But in Buchenwald, the political prisoners were in the key positions, in the administration and so on. When a transport of tradesmen had to be sent to Sachsenhausen, which used to be called Oranienburg, they put as many of the people with death sentences on it as they could. After a lot of hither and thither, I ended up in Auschwitz, and I'm just fine here. With my Musulman body, I was put down for a selection last week. The poor sods were picked up the next day, but I pulled another fast one. I'm not registered here in the card system as a Jew, but as a Schutzhäftling. I'm not part of the nameless army of millions that will go up in smoke here. There are documents about me. I'm involved in a legal process. I'm only allowed to die by execution. And they're not executing me here in Auschwitz either. They're counting on me as a Jew, dropping dead by myself. There are more cases like that, Hans told him. In Birkenau, there's a fellow called Boas, a French teacher from Amsterdam. He had got a job as an interpreter with the workers on the Channel Coast, using forged papers. He and two friends were caught, espionage trial, all sentenced to death. The friends who had kept quiet about being Jewish were put before the firing squad immediately, but Boas admitted to being a Jew. The SS officer told him, "You, Jew, you're going to Auschwitz. You'll end up begging for death, it will be so bad." Now Boas is in a good commando, and if his luck holds, he'll come through it alive by virtue of being a Jew. With so many Pfleger gone, Hans was very busy, lugging things around from the morning gong until night, when the gong rang for bed. Early in the morning, immediately after getting up, there was the kettle commando, fetching tea, bringing it round, washing plates, and making the bed. Meanwhile, the Stubenältester had already started mopping the ward, as everything had to be clean by 8 o'clock at the latest. That was when the SDG did his inspection. After that, there were all kinds of jobs to do inside the block. One day, the corridor needed to be thoroughly cleaned, and they were at it all morning with buckets of water, scrubbing and mopping. The next day it was helping the Scheissmeister by scraping out the latrines. One day it was unloading coal, another delousing the upstairs ward when lice had been spotted again. It was hard work, because in the whole block with its 400 patients, there were only 30 Pfleger, and half of those were prominents, Poles, Reich Germans, and low numbers whose only concern was organizing as much food as possible. That left just 10 of them at most for the heavy work. Then came the midday soup with a repeat of the morning rituals. One day after the soup, a messenger came from Block 21, Transport Kommando. 30 of them turned out, this time without a wagon. They were taken to the old crematorium 200 yards from the camp. It was no longer in use. Now that all of the extermination was being done in Birkenau, there were only normal deaths in Auschwitz, and the few bodies were taken to the Birkenau furnaces on corpse wagons in the evenings. In one of the rooms in the crematorium, there were enormous stacks of tins, the urns of the Poles whose bodies had been burnt there. In contrast to Jews, Aryans were cremated individually. A clay number was placed on each body, and the ashes were put in a tin urn. The family received a death notice and could claim the urn. But over the years, 40,000 urns had been left behind and now had to be moved to another room. The men formed a long chain right through the cellars where the three large furnaces were and tossed the urns to each other as if they were cheeses or loaves of bread. Never before had so many dead passed through Hans's hands as in those few hours. The tins were rusty, and if you dropped one, it broke open. That didn't matter. One of the lads had a broom and swept all the ashes into a pile. Who would ever request them now? They arrived back in the block just before roll call, which only took a few minutes. They lined up, the SDG came, the block L tester reported. Block 9 with 31 Pfleger lined up for roll call, none sick. Then the SDG gave a wave, and they were dismissed. After roll call, Hans had to go upstairs to help Dr. Valentin in outpatients. There was an enormous racket on the stairs. Jelena, as nervous as ever, had exploded in fury at a man who had tried to go to the latrines without any wooden sandals, barefoot in other words, which was strictly forbidden. In his rage, he had hit the man in the face. But Jelena had a good heart, and when the man burst into tears, he was even more upset than his victim. He raced downstairs and came back with a piece of bread, bread from home out of his own package, which he gave to the man. The years in concentration camps had left their mark on Jelena, but they hadn't ruined him. In outpatients, Valentin was already ranting. He was a half-Jew who had been a doctor in the Navy. Not a bad man, but a real Prussian. He would roar at anyone at the slightest provocation, but if you responded by looking around in bewilderment, he'd burst out laughing. "So, look who else is here. Dutch barns must be full of babies the way you all leave the door open. You were naive enough to think the Pfleger were going to the Krankenbau in Buna, remember? I just got news. They're all in the outside commando. So." And then to the various doctors who had come to assist with the daily dressings, "Come with me for a moment. I'll show you something." He led them to the bed of a patient who had terrible hiccups. "He's been like this for 3 days," Valentin recounted, "and nothing I've done has helped. He also had a high fever, up to 104 degrees in the evenings for a week now. What do you think it is?" They thought for a while. Hans suggested, "It could be meningitis. That often leads to symptoms of nervous irritation like hiccups." "Wrong," Valentin said. "It's typhus without the rash. Not infrequent. He's from an infected camp." "Isn't it dangerous to keep him here on the ward?" one of the Frenchmen asked. "Not at all. We don't have any lice at the moment, and he's been thoroughly decontaminated. Anyway, there's no question of my reporting him. It wouldn't be the first time a whole block went to the gas chamber after a case of typhus. Make sure you keep your mouths shut. Then the outpatients' parade began. The patients came in through the back door with their undershirts up or completely removed, depending on what needed dressing. Their wounds were often awful, boils and abscesses, and the worst thing was that they all had to be dressed with paper. After half an hour, outpatients stank so badly it was almost unbearable. On top of that, everything was dirty and greasy from Mitigal, the oil they used for scabies and one of the few medicaments in stock. Suddenly, Ailey stormed in. "Did you know Kalkar's dead?" They were shocked. "Didn't it help?" Hans asked. "No, it was too expensive. He needed a lot more sulfur, but none of the Dutchmen had enough supplies to pay for it all." They discussed it for a while, until Valentin erupted. "Keep your chit-chat for tea time. Just like home. I always had to take care of everything there, too, but I'm not doing it anymore." The Blockel tester came in. He needed four men and took Hans with him. They went to Block 21 with the SDG and picked up an examination chair that had to be taken to the brothel. There was a crowd out the front with a long line of Reich Germans and Poles. Jews were not admitted. Business had not yet started, and upstairs the ladies were clumped together arguing with the supervising doctor and nurse. The doctor had to be present when the men came in and paid their Reichsmark, Reichsmarks they earned as a bonus from their work. He gave them an injection and a stamp on the left arm, and when they came out again a quarter of an hour later, they got another injection and a stamp on the right arm. At the exit, there was an SS guard who checked to make sure they had both stamps. This was to prevent the spread of venereal disease. One of the ladies gave Hans a tug on the ear and said, "What are you doing here, boy? You're not allowed in here." "Just do your job," Hans sneered. "I'm here for mine." "Yeah, sure," she replied. "Arbeit macht frei, Krematorium drei." Back in the block, it was already late in the evening, and as always, Hans had to sweep the room before he could go to sleep. But before he'd finished, the Blockältester came and started ranting about the light still being on, even though the evening gong had long since rung. Quickly, Hans undressed and went to bed. It had been a long day, 16 hours without a break. And what for? For a long time, until he finally fell asleep, the madam's parody echoed in his ear. "Work will set you free. Crematorium 3." Time passed. Sometimes things went a little better for Hans and Friedel, sometimes worse. The selections returned regularly, and there were always more friends for them to mourn. And they weren't always the severely ill or those who had been worked half to death. People with jobs in the camp weren't safe. Auschwitz workers were constantly being put on transports to other camps. People who worked in the better commandos weren't safe from the selections either. And once they'd been put on a transport, they generally didn't last long. Who could survive working in the mines? Who was capable of dredging gravel out of the river 14 hours a day, often up to the waist in the water? Who could bear the blows and resist the infections? Spring came, and with it the sparse birds. Birds that ventured to this cold corner of Silesia, braving the bleak weather on the north side of the Beskid Mountains. But spring came, and the sun had life energy, and that energy penetrated everything. No barbed wire, no wall, no SS could stop the sun. With the sun, new life came into those who were doomed to die, and new hope unfurled in their hearts, like fresh green leaves released from tiny buds to receive the rays of new light. The air was mild and moist, the sky was bright blue, and hearts beat faster as they tasted spring. It was as if their blood had become more liquid and was flowing through their veins with renewed zeal, as if their souls were trembling in their bodies together with the air, which was shimmering over the green fields. A tension came into them, as old as the history of mankind, but new again now, after this soul-chilling winter. And as Hans and Friedel stood at the windows of their blocks, looking at each other, the unattainable, and at the mountains, the unreachable, they felt like Adam and Eve longing for a paradise, not one they had been driven out of, but one they had never known. A deep sigh, and their souls left their shackled bodies and floated off into the hazy distance, and for a moment, the camp no longer existed. The horrors had disappeared, along with the wire and the wall. Their souls, united with each other and the whole cosmos, billowed away over the river and marshes to that glorious blue land of promise on the horizon. Then they looked at each other again, and in them rose that one word, which they did not speak out loud, yet heard in the other's voice across the distance that separated them. When? When would their longing for freedom, for being able to love each other in freedom, be fulfilled? Freedom together seemed inconceivable, and a gruesome fear passed through them when they thought of the death camp in which they were imprisoned. And when their thoughts, no longer carried aloft by fantasy, returned to reality, her fingers curled tightly around the wire, and his hands gripped the window frame, as if they were both straining themselves to the limit to break something, something that was blocking them off from everything. Then they sighed again, but this sigh was very different. Now it was full of regret and grieving for the dreamland they were convinced would never be theirs. That evening, Hans felt ill. He went straight to bed after roll call and asked one of the lads to fetch a thermometer from outpatients. His temperature was only up a little bit, and he realized he was just suffering from the tensions spring had set off in him. But why not take a few days' rest? Paul wouldn't give him any trouble. Paul was in love. For weeks now, he had been sitting at the window of his room, watching out for that one small woman who was so friendly to a kind older man. Because Paul really had become kind-hearted since falling in love with a Dutch Jew from the women's block. He no longer harassed the Pfleger, and he had stopped swearing at them. It was an honest love on Paul's part, an honest, compassionate love. He and Hans had formed an alliance. Hans took Paul's notes and packages to Block 10. Paul let Hans take it easy whenever he could. That was why Hans was able to stay sick for a couple of days without worrying. Nobody would call him to account. He sent a note to Friedel with the kettle carriers, telling her that he was taking a couple of days' rest and she needn't worry. The next day, he got a long letter in reply. Dear sweetheart, I'm glad you're getting some rest now and not driving yourself into the ground so much. I can get by without seeing each other for a couple of days and without you taking care of extra food for me. Yesterday was a special day. I had been asking the Blokältester for a long time, and finally I was allowed to go with the Herb Commando. At 8 a.m. we left the camp. We walked a long way and also came close to Birkenau. I saw Lotte Spatel there and the other girls who left our block last month. With some of them, the experiments had been completed. With others, they had failed. There were also some, like Lotte and the French communists, who had refused to submit to the experiments. Altogether, 70 of them were put on the transport 3 weeks ago. It's awful to see those women in Birkenau, how they have changed. Heads shaved completely bald and with bare feet, nothing but a piece of sacking to cover their bodies, bound together with a cord. You know, Hans, they're not women anymore. They're creatures, asexual creatures. Our girls still look fairly good, but how long will that last? I spoke to Lotte for a moment. She quickly scrawled out a few words for her husband, Heine, but the overseer came up right away and gave her a clip. Then she went back to lugging bricks. You're right. If I got sent to Birkenau, I wouldn't last long. I'm already coughing so much as it is. It was a beautiful day. We looked for herbs in the woods, chamomile and all kinds of other herbs. They use them to make Heilkräuter tea. It was joyous. You could feel spring in every stem, in every blossom. Here in the camp, everything is as dry and dead as ever. But the woods have already come back to life, with birds and with new shoots on the branches of the trees. We came back late in the afternoon. I was dead on my feet. I wasn't used to it. The evening was horrific. Yesterday afternoon, there was a Standgericht. 3 cars arrived with judges. In a nearby village, they'd picked up more than 300 Poles, the entire population. Only 2 were acquitted. The executions were in the evening. We could hear it all perfectly. It was in the inner courtyard of Block 11, right next door. On that side, our windows are boarded over, and the Block Älteste made sure we didn't look through the chinks, because then they would have been sure to shoot at the windows. The mood in our block was worse than ever. The room orderlies were raging, and the clerk was lashing out constantly. They're all women, Slovakians, who spent a long time in Birkenau. Of course, things were hideous for them there, but now they think they have to make it hideous for us, too. If you'd been in Birkenau, you'd be long dead by now, they say. And that's why we have to undergo their harsh treatment now. Always that system of taking it out on others. At 7, the shooting started. We were so nervous, and it was so muggy and close in the room, and every time a volley sounded, it went right through us. It was as if it was going to be our turn next. We felt it that intensely. First the order to fire, then a volley, then the bodies being dragged away. And it kept on going like that. And then the cries of the victims. A girl begging for mercy because she was still so young and so desperate to live. The men who shouted out all kinds of patriotic slogans like Hitler verrecke and Es lebe Polen. The mood in our block has been so bad lately anyway. It must be because it's spring and being shut up in a gloomy room with some 200 women waiting until you're called for. And they call for so many of us. I can tell you some more about it now, as I know more or less what they're doing. You know about Schumann's experiments, don't you? He took Greek girls aged about 17 and put them in an electric ultra-shortwave field with one plate on their abdomen and another on their buttocks. It burnt the ovaries. But the electric current caused horrific wounds, and the girls suffered enormous pain. Inasmuch as they healed, they were then operated on to see how the internal organs, especially the ovaries, had been burnt. Slava explained to me that this method is madness. They want to find an easy sterilization technique so that they can sterilize all kinds of people, like Poles, Russians, and if it suits them, maybe the Dutch too. But this way the women are not only sterile, they're castrated as well. After the experiments were completed, they sent the girls to Birkenau. A month later, they brought them back for operations to see how it had worked. Schumann removed their ovaries to see what kind of condition they were in. Imagine it. 9 abdominal operations in 2.25 hours. They didn't sterilize the instruments once between operations. Then there are Samuel's experiments, which you know more about than I do. He's been at almost all of the women, some 400. They suffered dreadful pain. Anyway, you know that. It can't be true that he just removes a small piece of mucosa, because it gives the women terrible trouble and they all need stitches. When Schumann failed, Professor Klauberg came. He's apparently a well-known gynecologist from Katowice. He injects a white, cement-like liquid into the women's uteruses and x-rays them at the same time. Klauberg says it's to find a replacement for Lipiodol. You see, in Germany, they don't have any iodine to use as a contrast medium for x-ray photography. I don't know if that's entirely true. It could also be intended as some kind of sterilization technique. Well, that's enough nastiness for one day. Don't be angry at me for not writing more pleasant things, but you were so keen to know everything exactly. Bye, sweetheart. Have a good rest. And then 100 more sweet words and wishes followed, stirring that great longing in Hans once again. He leapt out of bed and got dressed. It was 3:30 and the soup kettle had already been delivered, but he was desperate to see her, to speak to her for a moment, to comfort her and try to build up her spirits. The door to block 10 was open. The doorkeeper didn't seem to be around. Hans hesitated for a second, and then, for the first time, went in, just like that, without a kettle. In the corridor he saw a Dutchwoman who went to get Friedel for him. But no sooner were they standing opposite each other than the doorkeeper came sailing out of one of the rooms and started yelling. Where did he get the nerve in the middle of the day? If she'd kept herself under control a little, it would have all turned out all right, but she screamed so much that things had to go wrong. Hans started getting nervous. Suddenly, Goebel was there in front of him. Dr. Goebel was a puny little chap in civilian riding breeches, which are not flattering at all if you have spindly legs. With his light sports jacket, he gave the impression of a low-level civil servant who's picked up something at a clearance sale. But the women hated and feared him. Klauberg could be reasonable sometimes, and would often spare a woman if she had some reason to request not being injected. But 2 weeks ago, Goebel had appeared and seemed to have come to Block 10 as some kind of supervisor. He stuck his nose into everything and mercilessly forced all of the women to participate in the experiments. He wasn't a medical doctor, but a chemist from IG Farben, the company that funded the experiments and had a financial interest in the new liquids. Goebel was coarse and sarcastic, and had the meanness that was typical of all these people who had never learned to lead and suddenly had power over others. Does the gentleman think it's a casino here, perhaps? Hans was not usually shy of an excuse, but in this instant, hatred flared inside him. He found it so difficult to suppress and felt such an urge to kick the pipsqueak to the ground that he was only able to stammer out a few incomprehensible syllables. We'll sort it out, said the mighty one, noting down the number Hans wore on his left breast. Hans slunk off and spoke to no one about his adventure. The next morning, Paul came up to him. Son, what's going on? Your number came in from the Schreibstube. You have to go up to the front of the camp. To the front of the camp meant to the gate, where the Rapportführer had his office. He had to wait in the small hallway of the Blockführerstube. Kaduk, the Rapportführer, addressed Hans. 150822. Zum Befehl, he responded, at your command. Überstellung Strafkommando Birkenau. He was being sent to the punishment detail at Birkenau. Hans's head was still spinning when the SS Sturmmann who was going to escort him to the punishment detail arrived. His legs felt like lead, and he found it hard to keep up. Midway between Auschwitz and Birkenau was the large viaduct over the railway yards of the town of Auschwitz. From there, the road followed a branch of the railway line, and after about 1/3 of a mile, they reached Birkenau. The tracks and road entered the camp through a gate in the main building and formed the midline of an enormous sea of barracks. 8 or 10 side roads ran off the railway line at right angles and were flanked on both sides by rows of 35 to 40 barracks. The left side of the camp was called FKL, the Frauenkonzentrationslager. On the right was the Arbeitslager Birkenau. So called because, although it was a labor camp by name, the conditions were even worse here than in the women's concentration camp. This was where the crematoriums were, four in number. Roll calls and inspections, food distribution, and commandos would have been impossible to organize if they had allowed all 200,000 prisoners free access to the entire grounds of Birkenau. That was why each side street, with its rows of barracks, formed a distinct camp. All of these camps had their own number or letter and were cut off from each other by barbed wire. As a consequence, it was possible for a husband and wife, or mother and daughter, to live in Birkenau for months without knowing of each other's existence, as all the camps were kept strictly separate and the only communication was between adjoining camps and poor. Still, contact between men and women, although highly dangerous, was more extensive here than in the small orderly camp of Auschwitz I. They sought and found each other in the food transport commandos and on many other occasions. Through their work, the capos and other foremen in particular had ample opportunity to come into contact with women. A lot of the female commandos were even led by male prisoners, and many a woman counted herself lucky to have a rich boyfriend. For instance, one of the men who worked on the bread wagons and had an abundant supply of bread to satisfy his girlfriend's hunger for food, out of gratitude for her satisfying his hunger for love. One evening, Hans met a prisoner who had been in Buchenwald. They talked about the evil of Auschwitz, where the moral degeneration of the Häftlinge seemed more advanced than in any other camp. At Buchenwald, the political prisoners have succeeded, after a long struggle, in gaining control over the entire internal leadership of the camp. They even had the cooperation of a few SS people along the way. If a Green, a professional criminal, got too big for his boots, he'd get a note telling him to report to the infirmary. One injection, and that was him taken care of. Are conditions a lot better there than here? Hans asked. Organizing doesn't exist at Buchenwald, only concerted theft from the SS stores for the benefit of all. A cook who steals something from the kitchen gets beaten to death on the spot. Anybody who swaps cigarettes for food is severely punished. It wasn't like that at Auschwitz. There, everyone spent the whole day thinking about how to filch as much as possible, and mostly at the expense of their comrades. There were complete black markets in the free minutes after roll call. In Buchenwald, the political prisoners boycotted the brothel. No Dutchman ever set foot in it, the Buchenwalder claimed. It's not like that here. Anybody who's not Jewish and is therefore allowed in the brothel uses it as much as possible, and the illegal intercourse between men and women here in Birkenau is out-and-out prostitution. Hans disagreed. You can't apply concepts from normal society to camp conditions. If a girl gives herself for a piece of bread or a liter of soup, you mustn't judge too severely. But it's just the same with prostitutes, the Buchenwalder said. How often doesn't it happen that a woman gets pregnant from a love affair, gives birth to an illegitimate child, and is abandoned by the man? She gets excluded from all kinds of circles, and prostitution is the only way she has left to provide for herself and the child. They had to rush all day long. Hans was in a building yard commando, long lines of men carrying bricks nonstop. Sometimes it would be railway sleepers or heavy steel girders that scraped the skin off their shoulders. They weren't hit much. The actual punishment detail no longer existed. Now and then they'd catch a blow or a boot, but it was rare for someone to be beaten to death at work. A year earlier, things had been very different. At work, Hans had spoken to a Greek who had told him, in a surge of self-reproach, that he had once given a mate who had been beaten half to death a couple of extra kicks. At that stage, the rule in the camp had been that you weren't allowed to leave the dead lying on the ground at roll call, but had to take them inside. Those kicks meant he was able to carry the body away with a friend and got to spend half a day resting. Another time, the Greek was in a bunk in the hospital next to someone who was severely ill and seemed unconscious. He had taken the man's bread to eat it, but the poor wretch had started yelling. If people had realized the Greek had stolen the sick man's bread, they would have beaten him to within an inch of his life. That was why he pressed his hand over the other man's mouth, but still he wouldn't shut up. He'd pressed and pressed until the man suffocated. Hans asked the Buchenwalder what he, with his superior camp ethics, thought of this. Hans himself considered every method to stay alive in the camp permissible, as long as it wasn't at the expense of a comrade. A Dutch Catholic, a medical student, joined the conversation. "My Jesuit once gave me an example. Two men are sitting on a wooden raft that can only carry one person. One pushes the other off and he drowns. Does that make him guilty? No, because if one of the two hadn't died, they would have both been lost." As an ethical guideline, Hans found that rather opportunistic, but acceptable if necessary. The example wasn't applicable to the Greek, though, because he hadn't saved his life with that one piece of bread. If he carried on like that, he would be forced to kill someone else for another piece of bread the next day, and again the day after. If it comes down to you or me, everybody says me, but it wasn't like that in the camp. You could obtain advantages for yourself at the expense of others, but you couldn't save your life. And since no ethical system, Christian or humanistic, can approve of obtaining an advantage at the expense of greater suffering by others, the Greek's behavior was indefensible. Conversations like this were rare, as by the time the work was done and the commandos had been dismissed, it was roll call, which sometimes took half an hour, but often went on for 2 hours or more. It didn't matter whether it was mild spring weather or pelting down hail. Then, after roll call, a long queue for bread, often followed by all kinds of inspections. A clothing inspection, for instance, to see whether there might be a button missing from your striped gala costume, and to make sure your shoes were clean, that is, not covered in mud. If you took each of the factors separately, it was possible to live in one of these commandos. The work was heavy, but in itself bearable. The blows hurt, but you weren't beaten to death. You didn't get much bread and soup, but it would have sustained a life of indolence. But the combination of all these elements, so much work and the blows with so little food, was unbearable. And the worst thing was the lack of rest. Work, roll call, inspections, fetching food, and when you were finally lying on a bunk in a motley company of 8 men from all over Europe, the futile battle against lice and fleas. Dozing off, waking up, scratching, then getting yourself under control again. Lie still. Just let the lice crawl. Going back to sleep, waking up again, arguing with your neighbor. Then you've scratched your leg open. You feel blood. That's going to turn into a sore. Please, no more scratching. Then you've done it again. Exhaustion and no rest. Feeling deeply miserable. At night, you have to get up, sometimes 3 times from the soup and early cardiac weakness. That means climbing over 3 men and having to walk a few hundred yards to the latrine, a board floor with no less than 40 holes in it. Outside, there's a sentry to make sure nobody urinates outdoors. You'd get a thrashing. Your neighbor, who's some kind of Balkan peasant, is more practical. He's smuggled a food bowl into bed with him and doesn't have to get up. But who's going to eat out of that bowl in the morning? No, you couldn't bring yourself to do that. It's better to walk 200 yards. At 4 in the morning, you get up. Undershirts off, wash. A few drops of water, no soap. Dry yourself with your undershirt. Often you don't even get a turn at the tap. Maybe you'll find a puddle with rainwater on the way. Then, it's still not dawn, turning out, counting the commando. After standing for a long, long time, the commando sets off. At the gate, the head capo reports, "Building yard, 693 men. Fear. If it's too many, if 660 are enough, the Obersturmführer will count off 33 at random. They'll be ordered to one side. Nobody will ever see them again.